Hi everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Software Crafts podcast. Today with me we have James, and he's a strategic executive advisor for VMware Tanzu customers. He brings almost 30 years of experience in distributed applications development, deployment and operations, focusing on software as a complex adaptive system, cloud-native applications and platforms, and also automation. Prior to join VMware via Pivotal, James ran product and engineering teams for AWS, Soasta, and Dell via Instratius. James also has written and spoken extensively about software agility and the business opportunity it affords. James was named one of the 10 most influential people in cloud computing both by the MIT Technology Review and by the Huffington Post, and is a former contributed author to GigaHome and CNET. He recently completed a book on event-driven integration for O'Reilly Publishing titled Flow Architectures, the Future of Event-Driven Integration. James graduated from Michael Lester College with a Bachelor of Arts in Mathematics and Physics. Welcome, James, and thanks for your time to be with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me.
No problem. Going to the heuristic slash pattern of today, it is use of standard interfaces and protocols for event-driven integration. What are your experiences around this pattern?
Yeah, so I think the way to get to why, why I've focused on this and why I think this is an important topic, I'm going to tell a little story about my time at a company called Sosta. Sosta was a company. It's been acquired by Akamai. But it was a company that was focused initially on using the cloud to do massive levels of scale testing and performance testing on major brand media sites and online retail sites and a number of other types of sites that had the need to test for very large scale use. So as such, as an introduction, they're almost more of a data company than they really were a testing company, in the sense that they collected massive amounts of data, and their job was to turn that data into usable information to improve the performance of these applications. Along the way, they discovered the power of what's called real user measuring, which is basically collecting data directly from the browser, from user browser interactions, about everything related to load times for every single component on a page. Out of that, you can also get information about navigation, about what they interacted with on the page when they did things, and just a number of really, really important, useful pieces of information for improving how your web applications run and operate. Now, what does all of this have to do with sort of these interfaces and heuristics? Well, what we discovered was that we could use this data and correlate it with information that we got from things like the navigation and elsewhere, and correlate that data to understand not only what did performance do to the outcomes that the business wanted. For retail, for instance, that outcome would be a completed sale. But we were also able to do things like understand how navigation affected those things, and understand and report that information with about a 10-second delay from the actual interactions with the site. So a little bit of processing time, but very, very short. I'll give you an idea. At the time, most retailers were collecting data from browser interactions through something like maybe Google Analytics, but usually collecting data through Adobe products, marketing products. And that data would be collected into a large data lake, and then they would run analytics on it, which meant if they ran a campaign targeted at a certain time period, they were getting the results of that campaign 24 hours after the campaign ended. And they would then go back and say, how do we need to revise the campaign, change the next campaign, right? And the next time they did the campaign, they could do more measurement and figure more stuff out. So if you're doing campaigns around Christmas that you think might be a little bit different than campaigns you do, say, for spring or for, or, you know, for early summer, then you can do all the analytics and everything, but you have to wait a while before you can test again. What we were doing is showing them the data in real time, which meant that for the first time, they could sit back and in the course of a running campaign, discover that maybe, you know what, we have a problem with a link or that is affecting the ability for people to get to the outcome we want, or we're running two sets of messaging. This set of messaging is more impactful than this other set of messaging, and see that in real time, and then begin to balance the load of what they do with the campaign. This was so impactful that we were also kind of building these big monitors where you could see all the test results and all the real user monitor results up in front of a room so that people could see the impact of all of this. Really cool stuff. And when we set these things up in the IT organization, at the first two organizations where we put these giant displays up and had the real user monitoring data available with the correlation, within 2 days, in both cases, the VP of marketing for the major retailer is standing in the doorway going, how can I get some of my employees down here in front of that screen, looking at that data in real time during campaigns? What can I do to make sure I get that real time feedback of what's going on in the same way? So that was my introduction to the importance of shifting from a number of delayed batch analytics type of jobs to more real-time analytics in place where it needs to happen. And so that began me on the road of what we'll talk, I'm sure, a lot about in the course of the podcast, of beginning to look at how can organizations better integrate, not in terms of sharing data files, but in terms of sharing real-time activity as that activity is happening, because there's a true value there.
Definitely, and thanks for that. And what was in my mind, where with this your first answer, was about the feedback cycles, right? You tell a story about a 24-hour cycle versus a most reactive, right? Real time, mm-hmm. And we can adapt. What did you observe back then in the behavior of people in the software development teams? You talk about the behavior of the VP of marketing. I want mm-hmm. this data to make more decisions. What was the other observable behavior on software development teams?
Well, it's huge because, and you can go on the internet and find a million of these cases, but there's a ton of studies that have been done over the last decade that show that minute amounts of performance differences have measurably positive amount of influence on dollar outcomes, right? So for media, it would be ad views. Generally, for retail, it would be converted sales. A 10 millisecond difference in a load time on something on a page can actually be measured to have many, many hundreds of thousands of dollars of impact on revenue. And in fact, Amazon had a case where they were I don't remember the exact statistic, but they said sort of every 100 milliseconds of load time equates to like $2.5 million or something like that of revenue in a year. So what we would observe is the faster you can fix a performance issue when you've identified it, the faster that you can remove that barrier to earning. And so the first thing that we noticed was that with developers was with the performance testing and with the real user monitoring was that they would be very, very focused. They would have performance teams or even performance specialists on teams that would be very, very focused on understanding that performance outcome. Because they could see in real time, hey, we've got a problem loading the Facebook social media button on our page. It's costing us, a couple hundred milliseconds to load that element the way we have it now. Can we change the way the page loads, or can we just, until we figure out what's going on, eliminate that Facebook button from the page and get back to a more, you know, a better performing page again. So for sure we saw that, you know, the organizations we were working with were working towards being highly iterative anyway, in terms of the way they developed and delivered software. I mean, retail were among the first out there to follow Etsy's footsteps and try to get to that multiple releases a day behavior. Back then, there wasn't a lot of companies really at that level, but the daily releases or every couple of days releases were pretty standard. And so, so that was a big change that happened there. I think with the retail and the campaign folks, there would be some then feedback that's not like, hey, there's a technical problem that's causing us an issue, but now, hey, we need to update the way that a button reads, or the way that, you know, or the location of the campaign on the page, or, you know, a number of other things that would come up as potential things that have to. So there'd be more of a real time during a campaign anyway, there'd be a more real time conversation with marketing and with other business groups in terms of what the technology was doing to the business outcomes. And so I think that was, you know, a big thing is for sure is that it opened a conversational door that was related to, hey, we're seeing this now, what can we do now about it? We need to have that conversation channel open to be able to negotiate those situations.
Very, very interesting. And you, in this part, you talk about the conversation and negotiation among teams with different specialty, right? Marketing and sales mm-hmm. and software development teams. So I think that you were nudging towards value streams and flow. Do you see the industry becoming more aware of the value streams and how do we need to protect them, or do we still have a long way to go? What is your perception?
No, so the book I wrote, it was Flow Architectures, the Future of Streaming and Event-Driven Integration. It really focused on sort of the future of how organizations will be able to exchange this information using event-driven architectures and using what isn't there yet, standard interfaces and standard protocols for exchanging these events. And it's starting to show up. That's why it's the right time to write the book. It's exciting. I think the next decade is going to be really, really interesting in this way. But there's also a lot of infrastructure missing and a lot of agreed upon ways of doing things that are missing for two disparate organizations to be able to use a standard technology and know that the streams will change. So in terms of value of streams, though, I think it really depends on the industry. I think the financial service industry really understands the value of streams in a huge way for decades, right? And they've just been looking at new technologies and the way to leverage the scale of new open source technologies and how to make it cheaper and perhaps cheaper and more efficient at the same time to do the kinds of processing on market data, on news, on social media, sentiment, you know, all those kinds of things that they can use to kind of get a picture of where things might be going for a given company or for an industry. So I think, but if you shift, over to certain forms of manufacturing, where in manufacturing uses events, I think quite well today in terms of IoT and shop floor control. But if you really look at the way that like an SAP works, as I understand it, and I'm not an expert on the SAP, but there's a lot of API exchanges of information, but there's not necessarily a lot of easy ways for you to add something else to listen for a certain event to take place or a certain action to take place. And so across organizations, you tend to have sort of as the parts flow through the system, that's the API call chain of vendors calling other vendors to kind of make things happen generally, with a few callbacks for ordering and things like that. So one of the areas and there are other industries that are, you know, probably even farther behind that in a lot of ways. Companies that, like a lot of small businesses and nonprofits, for instance, could actually have really interesting information to share with the world. But just the setting up the infrastructure and running that is just kind of out of the realm of what they can do easily. So I think in terms of value of stream, I think that's what's going to be really interesting to see how it evolves. I believe very strongly, I make the case in the book with some evidence behind it, that a network effects will be generated as certain valuable streams become shared via these protocols and interfaces. Other industries will realize they have something of value to share themselves, that there's a potential revenue, new revenue stream here. They'll start to share their stuff. As more streams are being shared, more customers go, hey, there's value to be drawn here. As more customers gain value and get things, there's more new opportunities for new businesses to introduce new streams. So today, the certain industries are all over it. So all over event-driven architectures. Retail, surprisingly, for the things like real-time inventory, like Walmart's a really good example, right? Real-time inventory of all their suppliers, they're using event streaming to do that today. But other industries are, or even portions of industries are still very much kind of moving towards the API driven interface and away from even batch files being exchanged or call response API requests where you just go get the specific information you want at a time, but you got to know you want the information. There's no informing you that there's new information available, right? So that's how I see it. And that's the case that I think I make pretty well in the book. I think the next decade, we will see a big transformation in this area, but there's a lot of work to be done.
Well, indeed, I also share the same sentiment with you. The next 10, 20 years will be very fun for us. And you touch in two dimensions, right? You touch in dimension of the industry. Some industries understand better the value, and other industries don't, or they cannot afford it. Do you think that the size or the type of industry you gave non-profit industries, is technology the major roadblock, or is other roadblocks to understand the value on these streams and these event-driven architectures?
It's a great question. That's a fundamental question. I think it is more than just technology, but I think the cost of integration, the cost of being able to connect these things for real-time activity data, I think that cost is probably the most important hurdle. If you're looking at, man, the only way I can go get this data is to hire a programmer to not only build me software that connects to it, but maintain that software over time. For a lot of companies, that's just not going to make sense at all. For more medium-sized and large organizations, maybe, okay, now it makes a little bit more sense to do it. But, you know, what's the cost in terms of labor and activity that I have to spend on maintaining that connection versus the value I get out of that connection? Well, okay, now there's a value line that's there that you're really not going to do integration if you don't have to below that value line, but you're definitely going to do it above that value line. Having standard protocols and interfaces for event-driven integration, so standard interfaces for things like publish and subscribe, and probably publish and subscribe is going to be the dominant thing. It doesn't have to be. There are ways you can do this, say, with just an HTTP connection to open a specific stream to a specific, open a specific connection for a specific stream. But the mechanisms make a lot of sense in publish and subscribe for this use case. So an interface that's, for publish and subscribe and maybe a few other things. And then two forms of protocol that are really important, right? One form of protocol is how do you describe the event data in a common way? That's the metadata about the event. How do you describe the time of the event, the source of the event, things that every event is going to want to share, no matter what, in order for processing to happen, even if the payload's not understood, right? So routing, recombination of events into new forms of events, those kinds of things. What queue do you place the event in when it gets received before you process it, things like that. And then, so there's that sort of metadata level stuff that you need. And then there's the payload itself. And the payload, it's hard to argue that the payloads are going to standardize so that any company can read any company's payload. That's unlikely. It's the same with APIs, right? With APIs have not standardized to the point where any company can, without having to look at documentation, get the information they want from any other company. So the payloads are likely to be standardized more at an industry level, or even maybe more distinctly between specific, you know, between specific people sharing a stream. But I believe that, you know, that there will be some form of discovery mechanism that everybody understands. It could be as simple as you just Google for a certain type of web page that describes this is the stream, this is the protocol, you know, this is the payload standard. As those standards come together, and those pieces come together, what happens? Well, one thing is you can build libraries that know how to consume that, because there's a real consistency in the metadata, real consistency in the interfaces. So why rewrite that over and over again? There's also tools that can be built to specifically know how to do that. So Kafka can understand how to process that, and your load balancer system can understand how to process that data and so on. And so, and that in turn means that the amount of code that you have to write to make a connection to a stream is minimal. What you're really doing is getting to the payload, right? Okay, I want to be able to receive the payloads off the queue when it makes sense to receive them off the queue. That lowers the cost of integration significantly. And that going back to where I started, that value line drops. And when that value drops, it's not like there's a linear amount of stuff that you introduce. I would argue there's a massive long tail of stuff that you introduce as new opportunities to use streaming. And that will generate massive amounts of new work that's done using real-time streaming when it happens, including people for some types of integration where it didn't make sense to pay for it beforehand, and it starts to make sense to pay for it. Yeah, for small business, whatever.
Yeah, definitely. I can see that going, and I'm in the mapping community, so I see part of your work based on the worldly mapping, so and discovering these opportunities, right? And now things can move to the right, to the commodity, and covering the left part. Mm-hmm. And also, my question is, when, because this is a matter of when we achieve this state where things, the cost of integration drops, do you believe that then we will start to have more and more agents, more and more capable agents in the network to do small batches of work? Will our software in big companies change from center of command, command and control to center of command, and have these agents making decisions around
the landscape? Yeah, so... Boy, there's a lot to unpack in that question, but it's a great question. It's the right question to ask, right? So a couple of things that I think it enables. So first, it absolutely, you begin to connect the world's activity through different forms of processing that happen with an event once it's been triggered. So there's a source, right? Standard event-driven architecture kind of stuff. There's a source that emits an event. That event may go to something that routes it, may go to something else that takes that information and looks at it and says, okay, this is a part of a long-term calculation. That thing will then turn around and create another new event that it emits as a source of sorts. While maybe that original event gets also routed to another vendor that can do something with it. So my argument is much like what's happened with HTTP, where we connected the world's information through links. And really, it's hard to find a pocket of information that's connected to the internet that's not also therefore connected into everything else, which is why Google can crawl the internet from a few starting points, right? Relatively low number of starting points, and find every single page out there that advertises itself. So in the same way that HTTP connected the world's information and created the World Wide Web, I argue that Flow will allow us to connect the world's activity. We will have links between all kinds of things that are happening that will allow for financial service companies to understand what happened in a manufacturing company that might affect the way that they want to handle their investment, for instance, right? And so connecting the world's activity in this way will create what then I, you know, for lack of having a better term, I call the worldwide flow. And that concept that there's an expected flow network that people want to connect into that has value, that has the network effects that things like, you know, the telephony and the internet itself has had to date, and that the World Wide Web has generated for information. That is the fundamental case to be made about the fact that this will change the way we do the architecture of our applications. And here's one example of how we may change things. Today, when businesses outsource sort of commodity processes, they outsource the entire process, right? And then they have to work with the vendor to say anything that they need to do that's special, they need to work with the vendor to figure out how do I implement my special thing. It is possible with the Worldwide Flow to envision a world in which everybody kind of maintains the process themselves, or at least the portions of the process where they have a lot of special things going on, and outsource steps of the process through the Worldwide Flow to vendors that can then take that stuff and you know, all the custom manipulation of data or whatever's already happened, it's now able to be processed in a much more generic way. So it's possible to see a world in which we break down things today that are larger black box units into smaller units, therefore having more things we have to deal with. But what always happens in that situation is the system reorganizes as a result of that. And we will still have, you know, there's the Jeffrey West, who's a scientist at the Santa Fe Institute, wrote a book called Scale that talks about how complex adaptive systems that have things that flow through it, things like cities, traffic, you know, trees and your body, your human body, they organize in very, very similar ways. And there's mathematical reasons for it that he explains. And there's structural reasons for it that he explains. But generally what happens is you end up with that sort of tree, branch, limb, leaf, or whatever, I did the wrong order, but you end up with that kind of breakdown structure, goes to smaller things and comes back to kind of more core. And I think that that is the natural way that all of this will evolve as well. I don't think you'll have a fully peer-to-peer world. All right. I just don't, it does, things don't evolve that way and stay that way. I think what you'll end up with is a few sort of core kind of processing systems. Probably the major cloud providers will be, you know, places where you'll see these hosted largely. But you'll have edge computing being a major part of this. You're going to want to do certain things, you know, in more local sets of data. And you're going to have, you know, billions and trillions of devices, right? All the IoT stuff that we have come to know and love, it'll enable, you know, the growth of that, in my opinion, to a certain extent, because it'll be so much easier to kind of say, hey, when I have this event, what do I do with it? Well, it'll be much easier to experiment with that and figure out what the optimal way to use it is. So I do believe that our software will be more event driven to start with, especially if it's about the flow of data from through the system. There's a term called data mesh that your listeners can go look at on Google. There's a community building around that right now, which uses a lot of these principles and has a lot of these concepts that they want to think about. And so I do believe that that change will happen for sure. It doesn't replace everything that's API or other forms of monolithic, but it does make sense if data flows to kind of do more of an event-driven approach. And I think that will enable you to be more selective about where you share data for processing and the granularity in which you share that data for processing.
Definitely. And that is a really nice hook to the next question. That is, comparing from 10, 15, 20 years ago, what do a developer or an architect needs to know today with this variety of integration techniques and the way that things are changing?
Oh, well, so what do you need to know today? There's a whole chapter in the book about things that you can do and ways of deciding what architectures to use an event-driven architecture is not one architecture. It's a, you know, it's basically more of a philosophy about how you integrate things. But certainly there are a number of different technologies that are involved. Things that range from, you know, digital twin models of massive systems like, you know, things that are built on things like swim.ai and other stateful event processing is ranging also to, you know, what Kafka does with log-based processing, which is really, really useful in a large number of use cases, but not every use case. And then even simple messaging, which won't scale as much, but which is really useful if you have to have an ongoing conversation between elements. So there's even a decision tree that I provide that you can look at the type of streaming you're doing and the type of work you want to do with the stream and make a better decision about what architecture, specific architectures you want to use. But I think it's still important to know APIs. It's still important to know how the concept of microservices, or if you're in the serverless world, how to use functional concepts, functional programming concepts to string together not only functions, but, you know, processes and, you know, process automations like AWS step functions, for instance, when to use a digital twin model, you know, and to understand a little bit more about how you connect things, you know, the right way to connect things using events. But I would definitely, you know, maybe pay attention to things like there's CNCF has something called cloud events, which is a specification for a metadata standard for events. I think it has the inside track at this point in time in terms of becoming a flow standard downstream. No guarantees, but it's really good. And I think as you look at, you know, and pay attention to publish and subscribe and how that can be used in your architectures as you go. I mean, everything doesn't have to be a call response API. And in fact, if you have data flowing through your system, it probably shouldn't be. A call response should be when you have a question to ask, you use an API. When you want to move data through a system, largely, but not always, it's better to kind of have the push from the source towards the sink, as opposed to have the sink having to pull the data through most of the time.
Well, thanks for this. I think that we end up with an heuristic, which is very, very interesting. So now the last question to close the episode. What are the resources that you recommend to the audience? Podcasts, books, blogs, other resources to deep the knowledge about these topics?
Yeah, I'd say that the heart and soul of all of this is understanding a little bit about complex adaptive systems. That book that I talked about from Jeffrey West, the book called Scale, it's a very interesting, very powerful read. It's Jeffrey with a G. So if people are looking for it. At a high level, an understanding about the meta pattern that we're talking about here and why, you know, one of the reasons why this flow stuff will come together is that's a really good one. And understanding what some of the constraints are in the way that this evolution will happen, that's a good one. I spend a lot of time looking in the book at concepts around you know, various forms of event-driven integration. So I definitely think, you know, it's hard to go wrong with picking any one. There's nobody that's really giving hugely bad advice. Sometimes they're overextending the number of use cases that their technology work with. But you know, read up a little bit on Kafka if you haven't yet. Read up a little bit on Apache Flink if you haven't yet, or on Swim.ai if you haven't yet. In fact, the Apache Foundation has a large number of projects that are really worth it. And then I'll just say, you know, my book is, you know, where my book is going to be really useful to your audience is going to be if they really want to understand sort of the basics of and the basic structure and pattern we're seeing in sort of event-driven architectures today, and how you can use that information plus Worley mapping and another mapping tool called Promise Theory, which is a really important thing that I use to validate the Worley map. Use that to be fairly damn confident, excuse my language, in the fact that this evolution is going to happen. I mean, I don't know the exact state of what it's going to look like when it's done. I can't tell you what technologies are going to win or lose, or even what companies are going to win or lose. But I can tell you that we, as an industry and as a group of technologists, we are going to be going through iterations that are going to get us there one way or the other. And so it's a really good book if you kind of want to understand and really internalize very solidly how these event-driven architectures plus these standard interfaces and protocols are going to change the world, and to be prepared for that as you build your applications. Because a decade's really not that long. In a lot of ways, if you're looking at the system of applications that you're building and maintaining as a either enterprise programmer or a software product company programmer, it's as you build the system, you better be thinking about these things, even if all the technologies aren't there yet. So that's what I would suggest.
Yeah, thanks. I will make sure that all of these recommendations are in description of this episode. So the audience can follow that up. And with this, we get to the end. I want to thank you once more for your time to be with us today.
Thank you so much. And wonderful questions. I really appreciate it. And it was a pleasure being here.
Thanks. You can follow us on Twitter at @SCraftsPodcast. Visit our website, softwarecraftpodcast.com, or visit our page on LinkedIn. Hope to see you next week. Thank you.